Cities often try to incentivize development. The thinking is more residents and businesses leads to more money. Now one West Valley city is taking a new approach.
This is, I think, something just a little bit different, and I think will be a game changer for the city of Avondale.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, Governor Doug Ducey unveils his plan for more education funding. Advocates launch a campaign for parents to not leave their kids in hot cars.
Las Vegas's population has grown, but not so its water supply.
And do school calendars reflect their district's diversity?
There is a growing feeling that there needs to be greater recognition of other religious perspectives and orientations in American life.
Plus, a Phoenix gallery downsizes and working on your late night backswing.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Valley weather for tonight, 30% chance for rain, and we're expecting overnight lows to be in the lower to mid-70s. And then for tomorrow, that chance for rain goes up to 40% when we expect a high temperature to reach 95. Currently cloudy, looks like rain could be on the horizon. It's 97 degrees at KJZZ. In Valley traffic, watch out for an accident on the 60 eastbound at I-10 blocking the HOV lane.
Arizona abortion providers asked a federal judge today to block part of a recently passed anti-abortion legislation. The law would require doctors to tell women they can reverse the effects of a drug-induced abortion. KJZZ's Al Macias reports.
Planned Parenthood and Star Family Planning are suing the state, arguing the new law violates abortion providers' First Amendment rights by forcing them to repeat a state-mandated message against their medical judgment. Proponents of the law say doctors can give a woman the drug progesterone to stop an abortion after she has taken the first of two medications needed to complete the procedure. The American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists says there is no medically accepted evidence that a drug-induced abortion can be reversed. Brian Howard is with Planned Parenthood of Arizona.
The measure we are challenging today writes junk science into law and forces doctors, our doctors and others in Arizona, to lie to patients.
Andrew Beck is with the American Civil Liberties Union, which filed the suit.
Forcing doctors to make these misleading statements to patients is just bad medicine that is harmful to women.
The Center for Arizona Policy, the conservative organization that pushed the law, denounced the lawsuit. In a statement, a spokesman said women who changed their minds during the chemical abortion procedure should not lose their baby because Planned Parenthood or other providers withheld potentially life-saving facts. The law is set to take effect in July. Al Macias, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Two top officials with the Arizona State Hospital are no longer employed by the Arizona Department of Health Services. An ADHS spokesperson could not disclose why Health Department Interim Director Corey Nelson and Hospital CEO Donna Noriega left the agency. Noriega became Hospital CEO after Nelson left to replace former State Health Director Will Humble in March. In a statement, the spokesperson said the department's primary focus is to ensure quality of care and safety for patients and staff. Noriega and Nelson had been placed on leave weeks before leaving ADHS.
The wildfire burning 30 miles east of Douglas near the Arizona-New Mexico border continues to grow, but as KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie reports, this type of fire will eventually benefit the environment.
The Guadalupe fire has burned 3,500 acres. The fire, which is on the New Mexico side of the border, isn't expected to cross over to our state. However, with 0% containment, there's a lot of work that has to be done by crews to protect nearby buildings and cultural sites. Heidi Schwell is with the Forest Service. She says despite how quickly the fire is moving, this type of fire is doing what fire should do.
A lot of the nutrients that have been locked up in this living biomass are actually recycled by this type of the fire into the soil. So once the monsoons come, the areas that have burned are going to green up a lot faster, and so that's going to provide excellent forage for wildlife.
Schwell says crews are using the area's natural features as a containment line. Investigators have determined the fire was caused by lightning. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Last week on the show, we talked about the first story in a ProPublica series on the use of Colorado River water. It focused on how much of Arizona's water goes toward growing cotton. Part two of the series looks at Las Vegas's growth and whether that city's longtime water czar, Pat Mulroy, was hypocritical in advocating the fast-forwarding of development while also talking about conservation. Robert Glennon is U of A law professor and author of Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It. He says the perception and reality of Las Vegas's water situation have arrived at the same place.
that's what makes the ProPublica piece a little bit surprising, because I think that most people have understood that Pat Mulroy was absolutely unapologetic as a supporter for growth in Las Vegas. So that didn't strike me as at all new. She had become a great advocate for conservation with some limits, but not a limit that would stop growth. I remember Pat saying so clearly, it would be like trying to stop a 747. That's no different than politicians in Arizona like Mo and Stuart Udall supporting the CAP for the growth involved. At that point in Arizona's history, you could not be a viable candidate for election if you didn't get on board the CAP bandwagon.
There's a quote from the ProPublica article. It's from this former Los Angeles water chief. And he says, what were we thinking when we tried to create this artificial environment that just is not sustainable? Do you think this is how this period of time is going to be remembered? But what were people thinking when they decided to grow Phoenix and Las Vegas in particular in the way that they grew?
I do. I absolutely do. And L.A. I mean, if you look, there was an incredibly poignant photograph in the New York Times that looked to be near Palm Springs area. And the left half of the photograph was lush houses all with lawns and swimming pools. And the right half was the Mojave Desert, which, you know, makes Phoenix look lush. And you look at that and you say, L.A. is like that. I mean, L.A. only gets 1 inch of rain a year more than we do in Tucson. And yet they import more water than any place on Earth. And so they lived as though they're in a Mediterranean climate when they're not.
Without the idea of raising water prices, are we headed for a shock to people's systems in this idea that people are really going to have to cut back on the use, especially in the communities we've talked about? And could that cause some pretty significant upset for a while before people adjust to that and realize that there's a new normal?
I think it will. In Arizona, we have stored so much water in aquifers under our recharge and recovery system that we've got a little bit of a buffer with water that's been stored. But it's going to be a shock. But the Bureau of Reclamation issued a report a couple of years ago, Steve, that was really interesting, and I did an op-ed for the Republic on this, where they basically said, okay, we're the dam-building agency of the United States, and you know what? That era's over. Yeah, the 50s and the 60s, the 40s, boy, that was a good run, but that's over. But what you can do is you can still conserve, and you can still reuse more water, and those two options remain the low-hanging fruit. It's water that you already have, and use it wisely. Phoenix does, you know, a really good job with reuse. L.A. does a pitiful job.
There's a photo in the ProPublica article talking about the golf courses of Las Vegas are only the most vivid symbols of possibly reckless growth. Do you think people get caught up in those things as opposed to the bigger issues you're talking about?
A little bit, but that's okay. We all kind of a little bit narcissistic, I suppose. And each of us can do a better job of conserving water than we now do. I think a menu going forward. Conservation is real, reuse is real, price signals are real, reallocation is real. What I don't think is real, and what I'm unfortunately seeing more discussion in Arizona than I would like about this, is augmentation, as the euphemism. And that means bringing in more water. Well, that's really what the Bureau of Reclamation did with all the dams and canals. And where exactly are you going to get this water from? Let's look at the mirror and be honest about what we're doing with water.
Robert Glennon is the author of Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It. Robert, thank you as always.
Pleasure, Steve. Bye-bye.
The West Valley city of Avondale is trying something new with regards to its development impact fees. More on that in a minute. But first, KJZZ's business correspondent Christina Hansen joins me to talk about what impact fees are and how cities use them. Hi, Christina.
Hi there.
So what are impact fees?
Well, impact fees are basically an extra charge that home builders and commercial developers have to pay when they're trying to get building permits to build a new project or a home subdivision.
Do those fees vary from city to city?
Yes, they do. And cities even charge different rates depending on where a project is located within that city's boundaries.
So what do the cities use that money for?
Well, the idea behind impact fees is essentially growth paying for growth. So when developers come in and prompt growth with a new project, they pay impact fees so the city has extra money to support that growth with new roads, water lines, or other infrastructure.
Do developers and builders end up passing those fees on to buyers?
Yes, that's definitely been their argument, and it's also why impact fees have been so controversial in recent years. So state law says cities can use impact fees for, quote, necessary public services like roads and water lines, as I said before. But up until a few years ago, cities were also using them for things like new city hall buildings or art centers, which home builders said weren't, quote, necessary services, and the fees were ultimately being passed on to home buyers. So in 2011, a new bill was passed that put some big limits on how impact fees can be used, which meant cities lost a source of revenue for lots of projects around the valley.
KJZZ's business correspondent, Christina Hansen. Christina, thanks.
Thank you.
Avondale's plan is to set aside the $2 million balance it had in its budget to pay 20% of impact fees for new commercial and residential developments on a first-come, first-served basis. For more, we turn to Dan Davis, Avondale's Economic Development Director.
Back in January, our city council directed staff to kind of present some options to help spur new development, commercial and residential, here in the city. So the incentive program was designed to achieve that goal.
What's the benefit to the city of doing that? Because that money pays for things that the city wouldn't otherwise have to pay for.
That's correct. Basically, the $2 million that's been set aside into the fund, the incentive program, is designed to spur, as I mentioned, residential and commercial development. The results leading to growth in local construction, sales tax revenue for the city, increased employment opportunities within the community, and then also an increase in our population, which really does a couple different things, adds new people, new consumers into the city of Avondale, but also helps protect our state shared revenue.
So is this an example of the city hoping to spend a little money to perhaps make more money down the road?
I think that's a real good way of describing it. It's truly an investment within the community.
What kind of development are you hoping to see based on this?
Well, both, as I mentioned, both commercial, we're hoping to see new businesses, whether those be industrial, office, and retail, and then also on our residential side, some new homes being built within the community.
Do you have expectations that by reducing the amount that developers and builders have to pay as an impact fee, that will incentivize them to do those things?
Yeah, as we've talked with the development community, they've identified our development impact fees as being one of those obstacles for them coming into the community. So as we specifically targeted that, we believe that's going to break that barrier down and spur that economic development growth.
What are the goals? I mean, how do you judge whether or not this program works?
Well, you know, obviously the city council will be evaluating the program on an annual basis. So if we're starting to see folks come in, we start to see new residential rooftops being constructed, that's going to be the determining factor if the program is successful.
Would the prospect of extending this be contingent on the city having extra money in the next fiscal year?
Yeah, everything that we're doing is very strategic and will be evaluated. We identified the $2 million to fund it this year. City Council will evaluate it as we go into our budget process next year and see how effective it is. If it is that it is effective and that we see some benefit to continue the program, the City Council in their deliberations for next year's budget could make that decision at the same time to continue it going. Or if they felt that it was succeeding and we don't need to invest in that anymore, then they could make that decision as well.
Do you know of other cities either in the Phoenix area or elsewhere that have done anything like this?
Not that I'm aware of. I think this is new. It's something that we saw as an opportunity to really kind of set ourselves apart from all the other communities. I'm sure there's been some examples of some other, you know, economic opportunities that other communities have invested in, but this is, I think, something just a little bit different and I think will be a game changer for the city of Avondale.
Dan Davis is Avondale's Economic Development Director. Dan, thanks.
Thank you very much, Mark. Appreciate it.
Still to come, state lawmakers finished their regular session in record time, but could they have to come back into a special session on something like the budget?
The later that you go, the more revenue estimates that you have, And had there been, had these higher revenue estimates been available when they finally adopted the budget, my guess is there would have been more resistance to making the kind of cuts that they did make.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. It's the show with Mark. I'm Steve. And that rain arrived maybe 12 hours earlier than we expected it to be based on the forecast. Here along the Broadway curve, we're getting some light rain and very cloudy skies. We're still showing temperatures of 97 degrees, though, here in the valley. Look for a 30% chance for more rain tonight and then a 40% chance for tomorrow, with a high only expected to reach the mid-90s. In valley traffic, there is an accident blocking the shoulder, 101 northbound in the West Valley at I-10.
KJZZ is supported by ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business. It's not too late to start your MBA this August. You can learn more about MBA programs at MBA Preview Day on Thursday, June 4th. Registration at mbapreviewday.com.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Huckenberry.
I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody. High-profile sexual assault cases on college campuses in the past few years have triggered dozens of federal investigations and a call for reform on Capitol Hill.
But when a student makes an actual charge of sexual assault on a college campus, the process of finding out what happened still takes place in no open court of law, but instead in front of school officials in a closed tribunal where there are few rules.
One question that we had was, and this is going to sound kind of bad, but we're not perfect in reviewing medical records, and there was no reported bruising on the arms or anywhere else on your body outside of that pubic region. Is that accurate? Would you want to respond to that at all?
The only things I noticed were in my inner thighs.
I just want to clarify that you were feeling pressured throughout this entire experience?
Yes. Very pressured.
I would like to know an ideal outcome.
I think it's expulsion. That's the highest level that the school can do.
The only reason you are hearing the sound of an actual college sexual assault tribunal from the University of Arkansas is because a team from Vice News got a hidden camera and microphone into a place that is neither open nor formal, part of a Vice HBO documentary segment on how the growing problem of college sex assault cases is being handled and what it's like for assault survivors. Gianna Taboni is a correspondent and producer for Vice on HBO.
I was listening to the hearing in real time, and the survivor that was in the hearing was very emotional throughout, and the questions were not easy questions to answer. But I would imagine when going through an investigation, whether it's through the criminal justice system or a school's adjudication hearing, that there are going to be questions that are going to be difficult to answer because, of course, it was a traumatic experience that this person went through. However, on Monday, we were in Washington, D.C. for a screening, and I sat down with Senator McCaskill and Senator Gillibrand, and they are really experts in this area. Senator McCaskill was a sex crimes prosecutor. They, created legislation for military sexual assault, and both of them scoffed when I asked them that. They said this was terrible. The panelists were not properly trained, and that's one of the things they said. This is a perfect example in your documentary. This is one of the things that we're trying to change.
What do you think the institutions are trying to do, either rightly or wrongly, to keep the facts from getting out, to keep this under wraps?
I mean, I think Senator Gillibrand said it best in our documentary, which is that a lot of schools really care about their public image. They care about their reputation, sometimes over the well-being of their students. So definitely there are some schools that have changed their policy and presidents who have spoken out, committing themselves and their schools to change. But there are definitely a lot of schools that either have changed their policy in a way that hasn't created change on campus or have not created change in their policy at all. One of the things I heard survivors say was, you know, sure, my school has changed the policy, but they didn't talk to me about it and they didn't talk to our organization about it. We're the people at the center of the issue. They should be consulting us.
Statistically, the idea of a sexual abuse victim on a college campus is not confined to women. But in this particular story, because of the nature of the survivors that you chose, did you get a sense of how widespread or how seriously this is taken by male students on campuses?
You know, I didn't. It's all sort of anecdotal evidence for me being on campus. And actually, one of the more frustrating things in producing this documentary is that there aren't a ton of bulletproof statistics. Being on campus, though, you know, I think it would be wrong to say that male students aren't don't take this seriously and aren't committed to becoming educated on how to prevent these crimes from happening. So, yeah, I mean, definitely, you know, unfortunately, we're seeing this culture of rape all the time with new news articles about, for instance, last week, Penn State had to suspend a fraternity for 3 years because fraternity members were found to have been uploading pictures of unconscious nude women at school. And, you know, it's horrifying, but that's something that has almost become normalized because we're seeing the reports with such frequency. But I think it would be wrong to say that male students don't care. I definitely talk to male students who do care about this issue.
And you say that one of the difficulties here is that it comes down to the account of one person versus the account of another person. How difficult is that for you as a journalist to reconcile?
Listen, I think it's really difficult as a journalist and also as, you know, to adjudicate these crimes for schools. It comes down to one person's word against another. There isn't a lot of hard evidence just inherently in these cases. As a journalist, I did as much as I could with the great team that we have at Vice to corroborate all details we could. But at the end of the day, we weren't there, you know, and no one was there besides the two people. So you can never say this happened, which, you know, of course we didn't. But yeah, we went to great lengths, and thankfully we had months to produce this documentary. So we had a whole team of people that was, you know, that worked to corroborate both of the cases that we featured.
What does Title IX do in this whole situation? Does it help or hurt?
The idea of Title IX is great. It's there to protect students against discrimination based on their sex and create, you know, a safe environment for students to receive an education. But there are certain flaws. For instance, if a school is in violation of Title IX, the law says that they have all of their federal funding taken away, which that has never happened because it's implausible. That will never happen. And so part of what is in the bill that the senators are proposing is that it would actually just be a percentage of the federal funding that the school receives, which, you know, is a lot more plausible.
And why is Title IX an issue in cases of sexual abuse?
Because if the school doesn't create a safe environment for a student, for instance, if they don't properly handle a case of sexual assault, then that student is being deprived of an equal education.
And Senators McCaskill and Gillibrand, who you talk with in this documentary, believe that the federal government has a role. Do you think students embrace a federal role here and colleges embrace an actual federalization of essentially campus dating?
I mean, listen, it's controversial. I think survivors are thrilled that the federal government is stepping in and trying to create change and proposing this bill. I think that they feel that if that pressure isn't put on their universities and the administrators, that nothing is going to change and that their voices won't be heard. And then on the other side of things, you know, Senator McCaskill said it herself, there are a lot of universities, there are a lot of presidents who are not thrilled with us getting involved and they want no part of it. So listen, it goes both ways. I think that this has become such a big issue across the country that I think it's a good thing that the federal government is getting involved.
John Taboni is a correspondent and producer at Vice on HBO. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
That's The Takeaways. John Hockenberry, the Vice on HBO documentary Campus Cover-Up airs tomorrow night at 11.
Despite all the media coverage of plane crashes, flying is actually the safest way to travel. But the barrage of crash headlines can leave people who are afraid of flying reluctant to board. One retired pilot is teaching these fearful flyers how to sit back, relax, and enjoy their flight. The show's Anika Klein went to his cleared for takeoff class at Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport.
Sometimes the fear starts in the airport, before boarding the plane.
Please, watch your step.
And sometimes it sets in even earlier.
I start thinking about and getting nervous several days ahead of time.
Michelle Elliott is waiting with about 30 others to start the Cleared for Takeoff class with Ron Nielsen, a retired commercial airline captain. Some are so scared to fly that they haven't flown in years. Others are like Elliott, who actually flies regularly for work. But she says each time is a nightmare.
So there's times where I will drive 3 hours instead of get on an airplane, and my coworkers have to do that with me, so it's a pain for everyone involved in my life.
The class starts with an icebreaker. Say your name and where you would take your dream vacation.
Okay, Mexico and
then Hawaii.
Then Nielsen tells it to them straight.
We are the safest way to travel on the planet. It is more dangerous to walk. You can't walk across the street or from your parked car at less risk than you can fly in an airplane.
So if flying is so safe, why are these people spending their Saturday afternoon in a fear of flying class? Nielsen says a lot of nervous flyers actively look for patterns of plane malfunctions, and bad news about planes is actually not hard to find.
You will never see a headline that says, guess what? Yesterday there were 94,327 airplanes that went from A to B and nobody crashed. But if one crashes, you'll see it for quite a while.
And there are new details overnight in the hunt for Malaysia Airlines Flight 370.
When the TransAsia Airways twin-engine turboprop went down.
When it crashed in a field 2.5 miles from the Bloomington airport.
Nielsen says these traumatic stories get stuck in the heads of people already afraid to fly.
So the key is I've got to help them do two things. One, get more facts. But even more importantly, I've got to teach them how to divert their attention anywhere but where their brain wants them to put it.
One of Nielsen's coping mechanisms is talk to the person sitting next to you. Distract yourself by meeting someone new. And to avoid panicked breathing, he says bring a drinking straw on board and breathe through it.
So let's do the same thing now with the drinking straw.
Next, Nielsen conditions his students by bringing them onto a plane and just letting them explore and ask questions.
And I say, go sit in the back. Go sit here. Go open the lavatory.
But the actual takeoff, that's for the advanced class, a round-trip flight to an airport in Southern California. And, true to statistics, every trip has landed safely. It's the show. I'm Annika Klein.
The Maricopa County Attorney's Office today announced the launch of a campaign to remind drivers not to leave kids and pets in hot cars. The Don't Leave Me Behind campaign will include mobile billboards and PSAs, among other efforts. Erin Radin is the executive director of the Arizona Child Care Association.
I think it's a great initiative and something that we should continue to remind people of in Arizona. We don't really need to see or want to see any more tragic injuries or deaths of children during these hot summer months.
In your mind, what's the best way to get that message out, to let parents know, hey, remember, you have kids in the backseat?
I think, you know, billboards and posters, just if it this is the kind of campaign that if we just see a little reminder, I mean, we all know that that's the case. We all know not to leave children in a hot car in summer in Arizona. So any just little reminders to infiltrate throughout the day, just so that there's no way to forget it, so that it's not a complex issue. It doesn't need a complex message. I think this poster campaign makes a lot of sense to just be a constant reminder for people.
We've seen instances in the past, perhaps most notably with Shanisha Taylor, who left her kids in the car while she was going on a job interview. It seems like there are some underlying issues. It might not be that parents are forgetting that their kids are in the backseat. It might be in some cases they just don't have anywhere else to put their kids when they go to a job interview, go to something else like that.
Leaving a child in a car is never a solution for whatever problems that you're facing with childcare. However, many people face very dramatic problems with the cost of care, accessibility to care, and having safe places to leave their children.
So what are the answers then, especially given the fact that the state has dramatically cut childcare subsidies for working parents? I mean, what do we do?
It's a really difficult situation from the funding perspective. I will say I'm really pleased with DES and the work that they're doing with some new leadership.
The Department of Economic Security.
The Department of Economic Security with some new leadership has opened up the waiting list and are being as vigilant as they can to continue to provide services to families as money becomes available.
So it sounds like the situation as far as childcare, especially for low-income working parents, it sounds like it's actually getting a little better in this state.
It is getting a little bit better in this state. I think that the problem is because it has been so stagnant for the last few years, we don't have a really good idea of what the actual need is. I don't think that families have known about the service or taken the time and energy to be put on the wait list and maintain their eligibility. But I really want to encourage them to do that now and encourage advocates to help the families that they work with to do that, because it is improving. And
we also need to know from a budgeting perspective, what is the real need out there? I think that's the only way to get the legislature and the executive to continue to appropriate additional funding for it, is if we have a real picture of the need.
Erin Radin is executive director of the Arizona Child Care Association. Erin, thanks.
Thank you.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name's Alex Cole, and we're at Dobson Ranch at the driving range. The cool thing with Dobson is it's one of the only lighted driving ranges around, so a little easier to get a bunch of practice in. Or in the middle of the day, you tend to burn out a little bit more. It's beautiful. Palm trees and makes you happy, I guess, like you're on vacation, even though I'm not. You know, really at the range, you're just trying to perfect your swing, and you kind of get a view of everybody's swing out here on the range. You kind of see what guys are doing well and what they're not doing well. And
there it is.
That's kind of what you chase every round, is those few good shots you hit. And so, and that's a cool thing. Even as an amateur, you can hit a shot just like one of the pros.
That's Alex Cole practicing his swing at the Dobson Ranch Golf Course Lighted Driving Range. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, or just think we should take a mulligan, send us a note to the show at kjzz.org.
Still to come, a Phoenix gallery is downsizing, at least in part, because buyers aren't coming in to purchase their art. And it's not the only one.
The newer galleries right now, online sales make up anywhere between 60 to 85% of their new sales.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. Checking Valley traffic. I-10 westbound at the 202, an accident blocks the shoulder. Another collision blocking the shoulder, I-10 westbound at 7th Avenue. And the 101 northbound in the West Valley, a collision blocks the shoulder at I-10. We have light rain falling here near KJZZ. Reports of light rain in other parts of the valley at this hour. There's a 30% chance for some more showers tonight, 40% chance for tomorrow. It's currently 96 degrees at 2:35.
KJZZ is supported by Mesa Art Center and Grammy Award-winning singer and composer Esperanza Spalding. An evening of musical vignettes incorporating theater, poetry, and movement. Saturday, August 15th at 8 p.m. Tickets at mesaartcenter.com.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The federal government's Office of Personnel Management says it will be notifying about 4 million current and former federal employees that their personal data may have been compromised. The move comes after the agency discovered a major data breach in April. Free credit monitoring and identity theft insurance is being offered to those affected. Hackers in China were believed to be responsible for a previous similar data breach. The FBI and other government agencies are investigating. In Ghana's capital, the death toll has risen to at least 150 from a powerful explosion at a gas station today where people were sheltering from flooding and torrential rain. NPR's Ophelia Quist-Darkton reports that Ghana's president has visited the site.
Speaking from the scene of the deadly explosion in central Accra, Ghana's president, John Dramani Mahama.
A lot of people have lost their lives, many of them through the flood, and then many of them through the fire incidents that took place here. We'll have to take some measures to avoid this happening in the future.
Witnesses say dozens of people had sought shelter at the gas filling station in a downpour before the explosion and fire engulfed them. Heavy rains have caused flooding across Ghana's capital, with buildings and vehicles submerged in Accra on Wednesday. Ophelia Quist-Darkton, NPR News, Harare.
Music in the Delaware State Capitol building today as Vice President Biden and family members greeted people who filed past the flag-draped casket of Beau Biden to pay their respects. The former Delaware Attorney General died Sunday of brain cancer at the age of 46. The Vice President fought back tears as Delaware Governor Jack Markell spoke of the close bond between Beau Biden and his dad. Markell said, "Never has a son's love been so genuine and deep." On Wall Street today, the Dow closed down 170 points. The Nasdaq was off 40. The S&P 500 index closed down 18. This is NPR News.
State lawmakers finished this year's session in record time, but since they adjourned on April 3rd, some legislators have suggested they may have to come back to the Capitol for a special session. The issues range from redistricting to fixing language in education bills to restoring cuts based on improved revenue. Joining me to talk about that most special of session is Howie Fisher of Capitol Media Services. Hi, Howie.
Hi, their sessions are always special for us.
That is true. So what do you think are the odds that lawmakers come back to the Capitol for some reason before their next regular session in January?
Well, obviously the big unknown is what the Supreme Court is going to do on redistricting. The legislative leaders want the court to rule that only the legislature, capital L, gets to draw the lines for congressional districts and not the Independent Redistricting Commission. If the Supreme Court agrees, and we could know as early as Monday, they would probably want to call a special session and redraw the lines in a way that might be a little more favorable to the Republicans than the current lines are now. Then, obviously, there's other issues that are pending. Certainly the question of, do we have more money than we were counting on? There are a lot of folks who are very unhappy about having to go home and tell their constituents, we really didn't put any more money into K-12, and in fact, we cut universities to the tune of $99 million. And if there's extra money there that folks weren't counting on, they'd like to put that back in the budget for the coming fiscal year.
Do you get the sense that there is any momentum among legislators, or especially legislative leaders and the governor, for a special session on anything but redistricting if the Supreme Court rules in their way?
Well, I know the governor definitely isn't looking forward to having lawmakers come back, at least yet. He has said repeatedly, yeah, we've had a month or two of good revenue numbers, but as we all know, a lot of this is based on things like corporate income taxes, and that's very volatile. And clearly, while we're coming out of the recession, there are still a lot of weak signs on the horizon. We've still got a fairly high unemployment rate. And so nobody particularly wants to bet on the future and wind up a year from now back in the hole. The redistricting certainly is a whole different issue. Now, the question becomes, do they just do minor tinkering with the districts to, let's say, buttress Martha McSally's district in southeast Arizona, perhaps give the Republicans a better chance in the district that Ann Kirkpatrick is going through, or do they want to start creating special things for themselves?
How much of all this talk of special sessions for various issues do you think is the result of the speed with which the legislature finished its regular session?
Well, certainly it affected the budget, because under normal circumstances, lawmakers would be here at least through the end of April. And as we all know, they have been here into May and, quite frankly, into early July.
Oh, yes.
And the later that you go, the more revenue estimates that you have. And had there been, had these higher revenue estimates been available when they finally adopted the budget, my guess is there would have been more resistance to making the kind of cuts that they did make. So having rushed out of here in pretty much record time, they avoided that discussion. Whether that's a good news or bad news, it depends on whose perspective you have.
Howie Fisher is Capitol Media Services. Howie, thanks as always.
It's always a pleasure.
Earlier this week, the president of Universal Society of Hinduism issued a statement urging Arizona schools which have a, quote, significant number of Hindu pupils to include the Hindu holy day, Diwali, when putting together their calendars. Arizona State University Religious Studies professor Linnell Cady says districts across the country have had to reassess their school holidays as religious demographics change.
There is a growing feeling that there needs to be greater recognition of other religious perspectives and orientations in American life. So the public school system is one of the places where this really becomes quite a challenge, mm-hmm. because how do you accommodate the variety of religious orientations in American society?
Districts are different in terms of their demographic makeup, too. So it might apply to some districts, but not others.
Exactly.
What are some of the complications behind that?
I mean, we can look and see that across the United States, a number of places, different school districts, because it is decided locally, have moved forward and honored different religious holidays. So if you look, for example, in Michigan, there are some school districts that for many years have recognized Eid, the celebration at the end of Ramadan. Mm-hmm. In New York City, for example, for many years, New York and New Jersey area, Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah have been recognized as school holidays, given the numbers of Jews, students, and teachers. In New York City School District, just recently, they have moved to recognize both Eid as well as the Chinese New Year. So you begin to see that other school districts around the country are moving forward in taking account of the growing religious diversity in the United States.
Most of the holidays, it seems, if not all of them, that have become sort of ingrained into our everyday society, the normal American society, tend to be those that are practiced by folks of a Christian background. Easter, of course, always falls on a Sunday, for example. Yet there is Good Friday, and in some cases, I suppose there are school holidays related to Good Friday. Christmas seems to fall into that winter break, as some like to call it. As we progress, again, in this diversity of religions or spirituality or faiths, will these holidays actually take on less importance?
Well, what you're putting your finger on is, historically, over time, Christian holidays became secularized in many respects. And so just the label, winter break, effaces the religious roots of that particular holiday. Now, one can argue that, in fact, it has become secularized, but still, nonetheless, it is a secular winter break, but yet it accommodates the religious orientations of Christians. I think Good Friday is a good example of ways in which this is practiced that causes problems. Policies can be changed that show greater sensitivity. I know in the school district that I live in, Good Friday is a day off for students. But it's interesting that the teachers have 5 personal days that they can take any time during the year. Even though Yom Kippur is not celebrated honored with a day off, teachers have to take one of their personal holidays, personal days off in order to take the day off. So Jews would have to take a personal holiday, which sounds fine, except teachers get a bonus if they don't take any personal day off during the year. So that's just a small example of how policies are in place in a number of districts that could be more accommodating to the diversity of religious life in the United States.
Professor Linnell Cady, Arizona State University Religious Studies Professor.
Thank you.
Governor Doug Ducey this afternoon released details of his plan to increase funding to public schools. The proposal includes using money from state trust lands. Jeremy Duda, who covers the governor's office for the Arizona Capital Times, was at the governor's announcement and joins us now live. Jeremy, what's in the governor's plan?
The main thrust of the governor's plan is that this would change the amount of money that K-12 schools receive from what's called the State Permanent Land Endowment Trust Fund, which is where Arizona has all this land in the land trust that was bestowed by the federal government when we got statehood in 1912. When we sell that off, the money, 2.5% of the money from that fund every year goes to a number of beneficiaries, the overwhelming majority of which goes to K-12 education. Now, under the governor's plan, that number would increase to 10% for 5 years and then go down to 5% for another 5 years. This would, over the course of a decade, this would, they say, put about $2.2 billion more in additional funding into K-12 schools, and then it would phase out.
Jeremy, the governor has been criticized for not backing up his words by supporting education. So what did some of the critics have to say today?
Some of them were cautiously optimistic. I spoke with Andrew Morrill from the Arizona Education Association, a couple of Democratic legislators. I think they will probably end up supporting this, although certainly they have questions such as how this money is going to be distributed, what happens in 2026 when this plan phases out, and whether or not these schools will get more funding on top of that. Some feel like this is a good start, but not far enough. Of course, we just saw the U.S. Census Bureau report a couple days ago that listed Arizona as basically being dead last in the state funding for education. So some folks feel like, you know, there's more work to be done, but a lot of people seem to feel like this is at least a good start.
Was there a sense of what specifically this money would pay for once it got to the schools?
I think those are some of the details that will have to be worked out. That's one of the things that Mr. Morrill expressed some concern about. You know, when you talk about money to schools, this goes to so many different places, teacher salaries, equipment, various different things, such as, and we heard a lot about this during the legislative session when Governor Ducey talked about, cutting down on administrative costs and putting money into the classrooms, although oftentimes this kind of ends up being a shell game where, money is shifted from one area to pay for another.
There was a big breaking of bread yesterday. The governor and Superintendent Douglas and other superintendents of schools, Jeremy, was this presented to those superintendents yesterday by Governor Ducey? Has this been in the works for a while?
It sounds like this had been in the works for a while. I mean, this is a fairly, somewhat comprehensive plan, it seems like. Now, I don't know, the announcement, I'm not sure. It seems like that was a very impromptu meeting, or a series of meetings that the governor called yesterday. That maybe this was in response to that Census Bureau report, which got a lot of press. The plan itself, it seems like, has been kind of in the works for a while.
So, Jeremy, this will need voter approval. Is this going to be a legislative ballot measure that they try to do next year?
Yeah, the governor is going to ask the legislature next session, when they reconvene in 2016, to refer this to the ballot. This is a land trust endowment fund. Funding formula is in the state constitution, so it would require voter approval. In fact, last time it got changed was actually in 2012 when this 2.5% formula was established through a ballot measure that Governor Ducey, who was then the state treasurer, championed.
Jeremy Duda covers the governor's office for the Arizona Capital Times. Jeremy, thanks for being with us.
Thanks a lot.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. Checking Valley traffic at this hour. Accidents I-10 westbound at the 202. Also in the West Valley, the 101 northbound shoulder is blocked by a collision at I-10. We've had some light rain falling around the valley this afternoon. We'll have a 30% chance for some more showers tonight. And then for tomorrow, a 40% chance. Might have some thunderstorms in the mix. Look for a high temperature in the mid-90s. Currently cloudy and 96 degrees at KJZZ at 250.
KJZZ is supported by AJ's Fine Foods, announcing their seafood extravaganza with a selection of fresh seafood and shellfish flown in daily. 10 Valley locations can be found at ajsfinefoods.com.
Bentley Gallery in the Warehouse District south of downtown Phoenix is 25,000 square feet, but this summer the art gallery will be downsizing to about 6,000 square feet. To explain why, I'm joined by John Reyes, Bentley Gallery Director. Hi, John.
Hello.
So why are you getting smaller?
We're getting smaller because we're reacting or acting, depending on how you look at it, to the market. We are closing in our footprint, you might say, for our exhibition space to 6,000 square feet, but the actual area that the gallery will take up in totality is going to be 10,000 square feet because we also have storage areas, we have offices, we have other things. So even though on paper it said, 6,000, we're still going to have a lot more space than that.
What's the reason behind shrinking the exhibition space?
Well, it was always the idea to develop the property. So, Bentley Projects is really the land, and Bentley Gallery is located on, Bentley Projects property. And so instead of just keeping it just as a gallery on that property, there was always the idea to expand to have other types of businesses as a whole, you might say, for the business plan.
How much of this move is related to a movement away perhaps from folks buying art in galleries in person to buying art online?
Well, it's partially that. There's no doubt. The thing is that we are seeing less and less people physically come into the gallery for our shows. And it's not to say that, that model is going to go away anytime soon. People really need to have this interaction with, with art, but with any type, not just art, but with merchandise, with any hard product, you might say. And what this is that we're realizing that also we have to change our business plan because we're also looking at going to other art fairs around the country. And so having a, smaller footprint, you might say, to do business makes us, you might say, leaner and meaner so that we can actually take, you might say, the concept of the gallery and go on the road.
When you talk to counterparts at other galleries or other facilities, are they experiencing a similar kind of thing where more people are buying online and maybe even some are, as you are, reducing the size of your actual physical space?
Absolutely. We know of some galleries that have decided not to expand. I mean, when you have a local gallery, for the most part, your clientele is local because most people go in there and they physically see the art or they have a type of understanding of the artist over time and then they become one of your clients. But the thing about being online and not just through our website but through other art sales venues, you might say, it broadens our client base.
How big of a deal is online art buying now? I mean, it sounds like it's really grown.
It is exponentially growing, and The newer galleries right now, online sales make up anywhere between 60 to 85% of their new sales.
If I go into the new 6,000-foot gallery space later this summer, how will it be different than what it looks like now?
It won't be necessarily all that much different. It'll just be a smaller footprint. It's going to be specifically designed as a gallery. It's not like we're moving into a space and not making any type of changes whatsoever. It will be designed specifically to exhibit artwork.
Do you imagine a time where you would sell art online that you don't have either on the wall or even in your possession in storage?
Oh, that has happened before. Sometimes we do resale, or what is known as secondary market sales.
What do you think that this move will mean for your neighborhood?
I think it's a boom for the neighborhood, actually. I mean, the gallery has been there for a number of years, but it's only recently that people, like locally, within the neighborhood have actually started coming into the space. They really didn't understand or realize that we were even there to begin with. But the thing is, with the gallery, again, being there, there's opportunities for other businesses, too, that are going to be coming into the space.
John Reyes is director of Bentley Gallery in Phoenix. This summer, it'll go from about 25,000 to a little more than 6,000 square feet. John, thanks.
Thank you so much for having me.
Many adults go to chiropractors for a crack of the back or a pop of the hip, but now some parents are taking their infants and toddlers with them. As KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie reports, parents seeking alternative treatments to common childhood ailments such as colic, constipation, and ear infections are turning to chiropractors.
Boy, she's really active today, isn't she? So right here is where the misalignment is.
Dr. Greg Mookney has been adjusting infants and toddlers for almost 30 years. Today, his 9-month-old granddaughter, Mila, is coming in for an adjustment with her mother, Janessa Foley.
Mila's probably had about 10 adjustments.
And her first adjustment was at the hospital on the day she was born.
Being born isn't the easiest thing on your body. So it's always nice to make sure everything's working.
Janessa carries Mila to a nearby table where she lies down face up. She places Mila on her chest, and Dr. Mookney begins to press his fingertips into her back.
Now I'm actually feeling her thoracic spine and her lumbar spine. It's like a slinky. We want to, when I push down on a spring, I want to feel it to give. It's like a cushion or a sponge. I push down, there should be give. And you got to be fast when you're working with babies.
There's no popping or cracking and no crying baby. In fact, the adjustment is so split second.
Did you do it?
I did, just by holding a very light contact there. And now one more right in here, just really light. Barely the weight of my finger on a key area there to help the brain and the spine to realign.
Dr. Mookney describes his technique as a tonal approach. Unlike traditional chiropractic methods, he uses a light touch to, as he puts it, reset the tension in the spinal cord.
It's like you're tuning up a guitar or a violin.
In a statement, the American Chiropractic Association says all doctors of chiropractic are taught to diagnose and manage pediatric patients in the doctoral training.
There's never been any science that shows that, you know, adjustments will prevent or correct a spinal deformity.
That's Dr. Greg White. He's a division chief of orthopedic surgery at Phoenix Children's Hospital. He doesn't advise adjusting infants because they're already so malleable. He also has another concern.
There is a school of thought out there that if you have your infant manipulated, then you will not require vaccinations against various communicable diseases, which there's basically no scientific proof that any of that stuff is legitimate.
But that doesn't always matter to parents. Again, Dr. Mookney.
They don't want a drug intervention or more toxins being put into their body, especially when you look at how many vaccines a baby's receiving, so many so early on.
However, not all parents who take their kids to a chiropractor fall into that camp. Some have simply run out of options.
I walk up his spine, I'm looking for the give. Now right in here, this nerve supply, T12, goes to the kidney area. This area also is responsible for the intestinal functions.
Mason Helmeet is a shy 3-year-old boy. His mother, Katie, says her son has had chronic GI tract issues since he was 15 months old. He also wasn't sleeping through the night. Visits to the pediatrician, blood draws, and lab tests.
And there was no change. So, you know, the doctor's like, okay, well, we're going to be more strict with the diet. We're going to take away more things. We're going to add more supplements, increase the ones he's already on, and we're going to test him again. So it was very disheartening.
3 visits to Dr. Mookney later and
he sleeps, which was huge. He hasn't slept through the night ever, let alone, you know, literally a whole week now. He slept every single night. He eats more he wants to eat more, whereas before it's like, please, please eat. I need you to eat.
Mason's mom says she'll continue to follow her pediatrician's recommendations, but she plans to continue their visits to Dr. Mookney.
Okay, Mason, turn over on your back. You did so good. You're getting good at this.
Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Be sure to join us tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock on the show. Among the stories we'll have for you, we'll look at a new report on the influence of Latinos on the housing market. A Tucson event aims to help people feel comfortable in their own skin. And Steve, you might just hear the phrase whiz bang. So you definitely want to stay tuned for that.
It's been a while, Mark.
It's been a while. 2 o'clock, the show tomorrow afternoon.
If you want to start your weekend off early, a lot of stuff to do tonight around the valley. The name of this band, Mark, I think describes both of us, Zen Lunatics.
Oh, yes.
Which is tonight at 8:30 at Cactus Jack's Ahwatukee Tavern.
You can check out Ballet Etudes Showcase. That's tonight at the Mesa Arts Center.
Tonight and Saturday at 7, Desert Botanical Gardens in Phoenix hosting flashlight tours.
The Diamondbacks host the Mets tonight at Chase Field in downtown Phoenix.
A lot of other things going on.
Yes, yes. Indeed.
Those are just some of them.
The show is produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, Annika Klein, and Alexandra Olgan. Tracy Greer, Maria Springs, and Sky Shout are the digital team. Our news director is Al Macias. Our executive producer, John Hoban.
We want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know about good story ideas. We're at the show at kjzz.org. For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. This is member-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. All Things Considered is up next. It's 3 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by Staples, now offering business loans to provide access to capital for small business entrepreneurs with one application and a personal advisor. More at staples.com/loans. Staples, make more happen.